Yes, I think we are, Russ. Good morning
okay.
to you.
Good afternoon to you. Why don't I turn over to Danielle to start the leases disclosure discussion?
Okay, great. Thank you. Today we have one topic for discussion, the lessee disclosure requirements. The staff have prepared two papers for this discussion, the lessee disclosure requirements under the FASB lessee accounting model, discussed agenda paper 3A, FASB 303, and the lessee disclosure requirements under the IASB lessee accounting model, discussed agenda paper 3B, FASB member 304. We will go through these papers together in three main areas, with the clarification that each board will be discussing their respective papers. This is so that the boards can see their entire disclosure package recommended based on each of their respective accounting models. We will first jointly discuss the overall disclosure objective. We will then go into the detailed recommendations regarding quantitative disclosures. Some of those discussions will be joint discussions, whereas others will relate to either FASB only or IASB quantitative disclosure requirements. Finally, each board will discuss the qualitative disclosure recommendations, which are different recommendations from both the FASB staff and the IASB staff to consider. Appendix A to the cover memo, which is agenda paper 3, FASB memo 302, provides a summary of the topics that will be discussed today and will serve as a guide to the two agenda papers, with references to the relevant paragraph numbers, the question numbers, and the pages for each respective paper. I will start by introducing the overall disclosure objective. This is discussed in the FASB memo on pages 10 through 13, and the IASB discussion is on page 9 through 12 of the IASB memo. Staff continue to think that it is important to include an objective for the lessee disclosure requirements in a final leases standard. The disclosure objective would allow an entity to understand the purpose of the disclosure requirements and the extent to which information about their leases should be presented, and it would allow users to determine the type of information about leases they would receive in the notes to the financial statements, and therefore how to best utilize that information for their analyses. Staff think that the lessee disclosure objective proposed in the 2013 ED accurately summarized the reasons why the disclosure requirements are needed. As such, the staff do not think any changes need to be made to that disclosure objective that was proposed in the 2013 ED. Therefore, the staff recommend that both boards reaffirm the disclosure objective, which is to enable users of financial statements to understand the amount, time, and uncertainty of cash flows arising from leases. The staff also recommend retaining the statement requiring a lessee to consider the level of detail necessary to satisfy the disclosure objective. That is, a lessee should aggregate or disaggregate disclosures so that useful information is not obscured by including a large amount of insignificant detail or by aggregating items that have different characteristics. FASB questions 1 and 2 are on pages 13 to 14 of the FASB memo, and IASB questions 1 to 2 are on page 40 of the IASB memo. With that, I'll turn it over to Russ to have the boards discuss the disclosure objective.
Thanks, Danielle. So with the respect to the FASB, are there any questions or observations regarding what's in our memo, paragraphs 36 and 37, which is the objective and the disaggregation versus aggregation principle? Yeah, Mark?
I agree with the staff recommendation. I agree with keeping the objective. The discussion in paragraph 35, which talks about implicit in the objective, and the following paragraph is sort of implicit in that, is the idea that you could scale the disclosures depending on the extent of your leasing activity. And I thought that was a good discussion that perhaps we could include in the basis. We don't have to put it in the standard, obviously, but I thought it was a good discussion perhaps for the basis.
In our small group meeting when we talked about this, paragraph 36, there was some discussion about the word understand versus assess in the framework. Did you guys do any further look at that?
That did come up in your small group meeting, but not in another one. I think given the fact that we had had arrived at this jointly, and it was a point where this had been the 2013 ED. We haven't, on the fly, so to speak, considered changing the drafting. I think I don't view if we changed it from, let's say, success, that that would fundamentally change the view such that it's a drafting question as opposed to a vote question. Jeff?
Yeah, I think I was the one that raised that, and it was a subtle, I thought at least a subtle difference in how you might think, understand, versus what the objective of financial reporting, and this ties very closely to the objective in Con 8 of the objective of financial reporting, but it talks about making for users to make assessments, that is sort of their own assessments, versus one could read, understand that we're giving the information, that management is making those assessments. I don't know that it matters in this fact pattern when you get to what we're actually asking for in the quantitative and the qualitative, but I thought it was a subtle difference, and if you're saying, look, there's some flexibility in drafting, you know, sort of makes sense to me.
I'm not so certain it's subtle, but there is a difference between understand and assess.
Nick, what have we been doing in disclosure framework and other disclosure improvements? Have we been using understand, assess?
I think we had this discussion, and it's in our ED. It's about an assessment of prospects for cash flows.
Okay. All right.
So assessment is probably a better word, and I think you're right that understand.
Anything else here on questions 1 and 2? Okay, Hans, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Do we have questions or comments on the overall disclosure objectives? Should we
talk about the change of wording they're talking about, understand to assess?
We've consistently used the word understand as I understand.
Or is that how you assess it?
That allows me to assess.
I mean, just seems to me if they're going to make a change, that we should think about it at least. Alan?
Yeah, I think it's helpful us to think about it. The difference I see is that I think, I don't know if that's the concern coming from the FASB, the word understand sounds inclusive and that it's, you can look at that material and you can now understand everything that's going on, as opposed to, as Pat said, it's an input into a decision process. If it helps you assess, so it's more of an input. It is a subtlety, but if the concern is that understand is that completeness, then I would probably have a look at the word assess anyway. But I think it's worth taking back to the disclosure initiative as, group as well, and we can discuss it generally and feedback into it. I think it's mainly drafting, but it's because I don't think it fundamentally changes it.
I was only going to say if it makes sense, we can you know, take the comments at the table and take it into drafting, and obviously we could respectively, you know, work together with our FASB colleagues in this with the word and equally just check with our respective disclosure teams to come up with what we think is the best word to use.
Stephen?
I'm sure we could improve the drafting of this, but haven't we used the word understand elsewhere, and might something be read into using assess here and understand in other standards? So I just caution against jumping to change the word without thinking about it carefully.
I agree. I think we qualify it though to help to understand, and that we've had this discussion before about making sure it's not complete by itself, but it's an input. And that's why we've ended up, I think, qualifying. I'd have to have a look through the drafting, but it's to help a user. That, to me, is the three words are better than just the one by itself.
Sue?
Yeah, I think I'm on the sort of same page, because, in a sense, we're giving people a direction to make us, in, I think, some sort of assessment that they think there's enough there for people to understand, because particularly when we get to the more qualitative disclosures. So I'm not sure that we want to completely take away that sort of mindset of we think there's enough here for people to get a good picture. So maybe Alan's suggestion addresses both points. I think we need to be careful.
Amaru?
Yeah, I'll just pile up a little bit, but mention specific when you translate, the understand has a much better meaning when we think about disclosure and presentation.
Having said that, do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
All in favor.
Yep.
Over to you, Russ.
Okay. Tom is not here, so he has proxied his vote. He does agree with the staff's recommendations on questions one and question two. With respect to members of the FASB, subject to drafting, who agrees with the question one, the objective of what we're trying to do, articulate, assess versus understand? Okay, that's six here, one by proxy. With respect to question two, who for the FASB, who wants to reaffirm the statement in paragraph 37 of our memo? So that's six here and one by proxy, which is seven. Okay, back to you, Danielle.
Okay, great.
Yep.
Thank you. Okay, so now that we have the disclosure objective, we think there are two aspects that will help achieve that objective, both the quantitative disclosures and qualitative disclosures. So we will start our discussion to talk about the quantitative disclosures. This includes information about leases, expenses, and cash flows that the staff think investors would want to see for all lessees with material leasing activities. And we will start with the reconciliation of lease liabilities. So this is on pages 20 of the FASB memo, page 13 of the IASB memo, where we discuss the requirement of a reconciliation of the opening and closing balances of the lease liabilities, which was proposed in the 2013 exposure draft. This was one of the most pervasive disclosures concerns expressed by constituents in the feedback process. Because of the potential cost to preparers of preparing a reconciliation of the balance of lease liabilities, and because of the staff recommendation to provide a quantitative disclosure table, which we will discuss in a few minutes, the staff recommend that a reconciliation of lease liabilities would no longer be necessary, as the additional disclosures recommended in the quantitative disclosure table would satisfy users' needs. And this is a joint recommendation. Both FASB and IASB staff recommend that we eliminate the lease liabilities reconciliation. So FASB has question 5 on page 23, and IASB has question 3 on page 40 to ask if the boards want to eliminate the requirement to disclose a reconciliation of the opening and closing balances of a lessee's lease liabilities. Al?
Just questioning the order, you're asking us to take something away before we vote on what you insert.
It could be a tentative vote, or we could come back and vote on it if you want after the
My preference would be to wait and address 6 and then come back and address 5, because my answer could be different. If we said nothing in 6,
right,
then I would stick with 5.
Okay.
Are you guys okay, the staff? That is the next thing you're scheduled to tee up, right?
Right. Well, we were doing the reconciliation of the lease liabilities, and then the ISB was also going to talk about the reconciliation of the right of use assets.
Okay. So why don't I send it over to you? I think we like to do question in our memo questions 5, 6, and 7 together. Why don't I tee it over to you so you can do question 3? Your memo.
Sorry, I was just going to ask our board members then, in light of the fact that the FASB board members have indicated they prefer to take the vote on the reconciliations after taking the vote on the quantitative table, would you prefer to do that as well, and we can hold off asking for your vote on both lease liabilities? Okay.
Okay, so then we continue with
the quantitative disclosure table?
Yep, we'll go through the table now. So as we said, this could be an alternative to the reconciliation of lease liabilities, and that we could have in the final leases standard a tabular disclosure requirement that would present specific information about a lessee's leasing activity, that is the total lease expense, cash flows, and other quantitative information. The staff think that the information presented in this table, presented in one location in the financial statements, will provide more benefit to users than the proposals in the 2013 ED. So the FASB will go through each of the items that we propose for the FASB to consider in its quantitative disclosure table. Then we'll have the IASB discuss those items that they recommend for their quantitative disclosures table. And then what I'd like to do is maybe have both boards discuss the specific items. There's a lot of overlap. There's a few differences, but maybe we can have a discussion about the items that we are proposing to include in that table before we take a vote. So for the FASB, page 26 of the memo has an outline of the table. So I'll briefly run through each of those line items. We propose starting with having a quantitative disclosure of your type A lease expense and breaking that out into the amortization of right-of-use assets and interest on lease liabilities. and also separately disclosing the Type B lease expense. The next item is the short-term lease expense, and this was something that we discussed at the March 2014 joint board meeting, where the boards tentatively decided that lessees would not, as an accounting policy election, be required to recognize lease assets or lease liabilities for any lease with a lease term of 12 months or less. But the boards at that meeting did decide that you would be required to disclose your accounting policy election to not recognize lease assets or lease liabilities for short-term leases, so that would be a qualitative disclosure. And then the amount of expenses related to short-term leases recognized in the reporting period would be a quantitative disclosure that we're recommending that goes into this table. The boards also decided if the short-term lease expense for the period does not reflect the lessee's short-term lease commitments, a lessee would disclose that fact and the amount of its short-term lease commitments. And so, again, that would be a qualitative disclosure. But this is a decision that was kind of made already in March, but if anyone has any questions on it, we could open that up. The next item is variable lease expense. So this would be a disclosure of the quantitative amounts that would result from any variable lease expenses that were not included in the lease liability. Then the next item is sublease income. And we have a subtotal for the total lease expense. Then we've also recommended that we disclose any gains or losses on sale and leaseback transactions. And then the next item is cash paid for amounts included in the measurement of lease liabilities. This would be the expense amounts that would go through your lease liabilities, and that would be separated into your operating cash flows and your financing cash flows. So this amount would not include, for example, amounts paid for short-term leases or variable lease payments, because those would not be going through your liability. Those are separately disclosed in this table. The next item is right-of-use assets obtained in exchange for lease liabilities. The FASB staff are proposing we retain the supplemental non-cash transaction disclosures because the users have expressed their view that this information is useful for their analysis. This line item would replace the item from the lease liabilities reconciliation showing which leases were commencing or being extended during the reporting period. In addition, the staff think including this information would help ensure that all disclosures related to leases would be included in a single footnote. This means that this information would be in a different place from other supplemental non-cash activity disclosures. So we propose that the FASB could decide to require the disclosure in both places or just pick which place they think it is best to include in the notes to the financial statements. Then we've recommended disclosing the weighted average remaining lease term. Several users have requested this disclosure as being useful for their analysis. It would provide a clearer picture as to how long the capitalized lease obligations would allow the lessee to operate at current levels. And it will allow a user to better understand a lessee's renewal risk exposure and the timing of future lease commitments. This is also integral to the staff's recommendation to eliminate the maturity analysis of lease payments, which we will discuss later. Therefore, the staff recommend requiring disclosure of the weighted average remaining lease term, and the FASB staff recommend that this be disclosed separately for Type A and Type B leases. The FASB also recommend disclosing a weighted average discount rate for Type B leases. This would help users receive more information than they receive today and is also integral to the recommendation to eliminate the maturity analysis. The weighted average discount rate for Type B leases will allow a user to impute an interest component for Type B leases that would not be separately disclosed and has been specifically outlined by users as something that they would like provided. This will also enable users who would like to see a split between interest and amortization for Type B leases to calculate these figures, which would not be found anywhere else in the financial statements. The staff note that for Type A leases, the interest and amortization would already be split out, and including in this table. And then we'd also recommend that there be, I think I already said the gains and losses on the sale and leaseback transactions. So I think that's it. And so I think we can either talk about the FASB requirements right now, or have the ISB kind of go through their table and. Yeah, with Catherine, she's at the ISB table.
Okay. What do you want to do?
Discuss that second.
So, okay, so we'll talk about the tee up that Danielle had approached. This is Tom Linsmeyer's statement regarding questions 6 and 7. Tom prefers that separate tables or sections of one table be provided for both Type A and Type B leases and short-term leases. He says the reason is that some users will want to attempt to adjust reported numbers for both finance and operating leases to a whole asset view, and the nature and magnitude of adjustments that will need to be made to get to a whole asset view for finance versus operating leases is significantly different. The adjustments for finance type leases would be minimal, and the adjustments for operating leases are likely to be far more substantial. Separate presentation of amounts for finance and operating leases will significantly improve users' ability to make those differential adjustments. Also, preparers should incur no additional cost in gathering this information, given that they have told us they have separate information systems for finance and operating leases. So that's one point he has. The second point he has is in the label of the row, which is ROU assets obtained in exchange for lease liabilities, he believes should be changed to liabilities created due to lease commitments and extensions this period. Discussions with the staff at his in private made it clear these two labels will result in the same number being reported. He prefers his label for the following reasons. First, he believes that it clearly communicates both commencement and extension should be included. It's consistent with what users want, and it conceptually, the FASB's model is driven from a liability perspective with the asset amount following from it, not vice versa. So that's kind of where Tom is. I'll open discussion to others. Larry?
So I have a couple points, probably none of which will see the light of day, but first of all, I don't agree with prescribing the use of a table. I personally believe that footnotes are a communication tool, and companies ought to be able to present their information to communicate what they think is most important in the way that they feel is the best way to communicate. So I don't necessarily disagree with the items on the list, except for the ones I'm going to mention. I don't think we as standard setters ought to be prescribing specific ways or tables, et cetera. And I felt that way consistently while I've been on the board. Secondly, although the boards voted on this, I think you said last March, in terms of short-term lease expense, I would not include that disclosure requirement. I think it somewhat defeats the purpose of having a short-term exemption. In terms of cost savings, because constituents, rather than just putting a short-term lease into a payable system, now they're going to have to track it in a certain way in order to compile that information. So I think from a cost-benefit standpoint, the cost that we were hoping to save with respect to short-term leases is gone by the requirement. So I would not require that. And the only other question, which we did not discuss at our small group meeting, and I don't know if it came up with the others, is the requirement to disclose the ROU assets obtained or the liabilities, as Tom indicated. Do we have any assessment of what extra costs that might introduce in compiling the information? Because at least part of the decision by the FASB about Type B leases was the degree to which we thought how constituents would, in fact, calculate the lease liability and the fact that they could do so just at year end based upon a present value of the discounted cash flows in the future and not really... And to me, by requiring this, there's an extra step that now is going to have to be required by the preparers and the auditors, et cetera. And I just think it's
somewhat costly, but...
Well, I think we would address that in two ways. One, this disclosure would be new for operating leases. It's already required for capital leases. So
I'm just talking operating leases.
Okay. But I just want to make sure that, you know, everybody listening, we understand that this is now just extending to the fact that it's always been the notion that if you obtain a lease asset in return for a lease obligation, which only happened for capital leases in the past, you disclose this. So that's the rationale behind why we extended it. In terms of effort, what you're noticing is one of the differences, for example, between the ISB proposals when they get to it and ours, is we take ours directionally from the establishment of the lease liability. They are going to propose, and not to steal Catherine's thunder, but they're going to talk about all total right-of-use asset additions. Now, this is because fundamentally they look at the asset as driving the accounting. On our side, what we've been told by the constituents in describing the approach you described for accounting, they're going to keep doing what they do today, or at least they'd be able to keep doing what they do today. They're going to input that lease into, it may just be an Excel schedule that they're track, but they're still going to be able to know if it's organized by columns. They're certainly going to have in that schedule, when did I put that lease on and what amount. So if I, during the course of a year, 12/31/2015 hits, beginning on 1/1/16, I'm going to start inputting any new leases I enter into this schedule. It's going to be in this system that they've been using without any additional or different system requirement. And we think that that means we aren't mandating some significant incremental new cost, but it's also important to our analysis when we think about cost benefit that this line item, along with the cash paid for amounts included in the measurement of lease liabilities, are the two line items that when users said, of all the disclosures you proposed in the 2013 ED, we can get rid of the reconciliation, but we need and very much want those two numbers, the new lease liabilities incurred and the cash to pay down those lease liabilities. So to some extent, even if there was some incremental cost to doing this, we don't think that cost is a new system requirement, and we think it's very important to users based on what they've told us. So that was our thinking that drove that.
Just a couple of follow-on questions. This line item we're talking about, it literally is just the journal entry from booking the liability. It's the other side of the journal entry from booking the liability, right? Mm-hmm. So the company's already gone through the cost of determining the journal entry, gone through the cost of, in theory, having that audited or passed if it's not significant. This is just...
Okay. My point was they didn't have to, okay? And let's take a private company who only reports on an annual basis.
Right.
Okay, for the year in which they enter into a lease, let's say they enter into a lease on 2, they're 12/31, they enter into a new lease on 2/1. Okay, they don't have to do anything except go through their payable system from 2/1 to 12/31, and then at 12/31, all they have to do is look at the remaining cash payments that need to be made and then discount those. So that's my concern.
Yep. But so just to clarify that point is what we think, however, is that, you know, when we had a group of preparers come in and show us how they would apply this model, for example, they're not waiting until 12/31 to put the lease into their system. So, for example, picture a system that may be as simple as leases 1 through 10, a description of it, and then it has years along the top or quarters, and you schedule out your lease payments. You're going to drop in that full lease. So you're going to be able to more or less see, okay, well, here's everything that came in new after my 1/1/2016 date. And you'll see the summation of what that was.
Okay, so then your response to me is based upon the information the preparers that you've talked to have told you how they're going to create their spreadsheets or what have you, you don't think it is more costly?
That's my impression from what we were told.
But I think, if I could interject here, I think Larry's comment, though, ties in with what I think some people understood as we were describing how easy our model would be to implement. We would say things like, well, you just take the information that's in today's footnote, discount, and put it on the balance sheet. And I think to Larry's point, some people might not, quote, drop this in along the way, but, you know, might wait until the end of the period, do what they normally do, and then capitalize on the balance sheet. So, I mean, that's possible, I think, what he's describing. if that were their process, then it might be more costly.
I think even if you're backfilling, I understand, and I don't think it's universal. The larger preparers that we talked to, I think, probably will do it the way we described. But let's assume that you entered into a lease in the middle of the year, and you aren't going to actually do anything till the end of the year. In order to calculate your footnote today and figure out what are my remaining payments, you implicitly have to know what your total payments are. It's when you look at that lease, you're going to say, well, I've been paying $100 per month. It's not like that's information you don't have. You may not have previously populated that the first 6 months of that $100 are left, but you will look at it and say, oh, well, my lease term is June 1 to June 1, 3 years later. That means 7 months are gone. I'm paying $100 a month, so here's my $2,300 left. So implicitly, you have to go through that process in order to even figure out what you're doing for the footnote today is the way we thought about it.
Right. You'll still have to have an inventory of all your leases and the payment schedules.
So in terms of the importance of my comments, the overriding one is the use of tables, because that crosses all standards. Secondly, the short-term leases, and third would be this.
Hal?
Larry, I appreciate your comment about the tables, and you know, maybe it shouldn't be part of the standard, but as a user, I would think that this is probably the best format. So while we may not require it, I think at minimum in our example, in the standard, we ought to show the table, because it really
totally
does,
agree with that.
Really does pull together a lot of the information. I want to go back to a couple points. First of all, we suggest in here that the number called total lease expense, and you've got the amounts there, does this tie back to the income statement or statement of performance?
It would not tie back to the income statement, because these items might be in different places. So they're going to be pulled from different line items in your income statement, and this is trying to pull together your total lease expense.
The other thing that we highlight with a footnote in here, and this is consistent between the ISB proposal and ours, is that we are intending to capture, and some people commented on how we might label this, but this is really a total lease cost, right? So if you understand that what we learned during our outreach process after the 2013 ED is that some users have and may continue, though they might adjust somewhat for the disclosures we're making, take a total measure of lease cost and multiply it times 6x or whatever to try and approximate a whole asset number. We think it's important that this table include your actual straight line rent cost, even if you are taking a portion of your $100 and allocating it to a capitalized asset.
Okay.
So that also wouldn't reconcile to the expense you're flowing through your income statement for the period.
Or at a minimum, I would ask the staff to kind of rethink this table and make that a little bit more clear, because when you first pick it up, it looks like it's going to tie the income statement, and it does not. Second, to your point about I'm going to take a multiple and try to do maybe a whole asset, which was, I think, Tom's proxy comment, that seems to argue in terms of taking the items that aren't already split between A and B and splitting them between A and B types of leases, you know, the short term, the variable, and the sublease income. What thought was given to not splitting that? Is there a counter argument to that? Because it seems like the argument to split them is pretty strong, particularly if I'm taking a whole asset approach and I'm going to put some multiple on this cost number, and I may put a different multiple between an A and a B, because part of the argument of having A and B accounting was that there were different economics here between A and B. So if we go down that path, and that's where we are, it seems like to complete the picture, you would have to split all the numbers between A and B.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess that factored into why we had a split weighted average remaining lease term disclosure was the difference we think generally in lives between equipment and what are oftentimes property assets. I'm not sure that we specifically considered doing or not doing an A-B split for some of the others. It isn't something that had been suggested to us, and to some extent there's a view that we weren't trying to create three pages of footnotes, so we could add, you know, a column for virtually every one of these disclosures. You could have A versus B difference, right of use assets obtained in exchange for lease liabilities. That could be A-B. Cash paid could be A-B.
They all could be A-B.
Well, so, except for probably, except for short-term and variable leases.
But again, I think part of the argument for having A versus B leases was different economics. So if that's the argument, why are we continuing to merge certain of these costs into a single number? So my preference would be for us to split that for each of the individual items and keep them separate. The final comment is on this average weighted average discount rate. You only show the B. There was some argument as to why you would not show an A. Part of it was because you could calculate it, but in fact you really can't calculate it. You can make some ballpark estimates of what it is, but you can't really calculate it. So I'd also encourage us to include the weighted average discount rate for the A leases as well.
You made a point about variable leases for A. We can't do that?
Well, this is part of, and I'll ask Nick to weigh in if he has anything to add here, but point being is that part of the reason why we're having cash paid for amounts included in the measurement of lease liabilities rather than total cash paid is because things like variable lease payments flow generally just through, you get an invoice and you flow it through your procurement system. And as you pay these amounts, they are not necessarily going to be, and likely I think are not, allocated to a particular lease. So going back and determining whether a particular variable lease payment related to a type A lease versus a type B lease, we don't think would be possible.
So you're saying basically you'd have to have substantial system changes to differentiate the variable leases by the variable lease expense by lease, and you're not sure that's worth the benefit associated is worth the cost of doing it. It wasn't that the variable lease was in the type A liability already. It's a system issue, I understand.
But if you're taking a whole asset approach and you've got variable components in each of your A and B leases, and you've got expected different lives for those, why would that not be relevant?
It would be relevant if you view the variable lease as part of the lease liability and the asset. If you don't view that, then you don't need to separate it. So it's really a question about what you think of when you think of variable lease payments. So I agree the whole asset approach, you would want to put that and differentiate it. Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
And there were some who debated whether the variable was a component of the lease or not.
Okay. I think what's important, if we're going to consider, for example, what Hal said, and Tom had mentioned this as well, and of course it's in his proxy, is that in general it was our understanding through this process that most preparers track these two things separately because they're accounted for today so separately. So I am not sure, other than the cost of adding a couple lines to the table, that for things that would be in your lease liability, that it's really any more costly to show things like, you know, the cash paid or the right of use assets obtained in exchange for lease liabilities by A versus B, because they're already tracked separately by most companies anyway. But for the things like variable lease expense, that would be something where there isn't going to be a separate tracking. So that would be far more costly, in our view, to do on an A-B split than any of the other items that basically are derived from the lease liability.
Yeah, Jenny.
I was just going to say that in converting to a whole asset view, I think that there's a perception, rightly or wrongly, that the renewals and the lease term is a much more important factor in doing so, and that the variable lease payments are less important in doing so. I mean, of course, if we could get that information, I think it would be useful. Mm-hmm. But I think the renewals and the average lease term are really a lot more important than that.
Mark?
I was going to agree with Tom and Hal with everything Tom said in his proxy, basically, and what Hal has said as well. Just wanted to make the point that we had proposed rolling forward both the A and the B separately, liability-wise, right? The A and the B liability would have had cash paid for the A and B that were in the A and B liability would have had them separately. So this table wouldn't then aggregate them. It is one of the most important things that users said in the IAC meeting and in other places that they wanted, so I don't know why we wouldn't at minimum separate out the cash flow. Second point is, again, with the ROU, the labeling is important. Hal talked about the total lease expense. The labeling is important. Tom talked about the ROU asset obtained in exchange for lease financing. I think we could work on the drafting of those labels. I do think it is important. But on that ROU asset obtained in exchange for lease liabilities, again, I would have, at a minimum, broken that out between A and B, if we're not going to get all of it A and B. Because, again, this was something that I personally used to use as an analyst. I would look at this as sort of a proxy for in addition to capital expenditures. I would look at total CapEx on the cash flow statement, and I would look at the leases you obtained, the lease assets that you obtained, not through cash. So I would look at those separately as well for CapEx purposes. And so I would, and the users, again, in your IAC letter said that they wanted those two pieces. So I would at least break out those two lines, A and B, if nothing else, and think through the labeling in the drafting.
A and B on cash flow?
Cash flow and the ROU assets obtained in exchange for lease liabilities.
You'd break that out between A and B as well?
Yeah.
Okay. Jim?
So I had several points, many of which have already been raised. I agree with Larry. I would not be prescriptive and say this must be in a table, but I'd be fine illustrating it that way. I don't know how to respond, for example, if someone actually provided the data outside of a table, would we say that's an error? I wouldn't have thought so. So prescribing it as a table is just hard to do in my mind. I also had a question on the short-term lease disclosure and whether that would be inclusive. One, operationally, if we can't solve this, then I would agree with Larry, because I think technically things like hotel stays or day rents on a rental car are short-term leases. Many of those things come through expense reports. I don't know that entities today track in their expense reports and their reimbursement to employees the amount of that reimbursement that relates to short-term leases. Although for many companies, that could be very significant in terms of dollar amount. So if we're going to say all short-term leases need to be disclosed, I think it could be exceedingly expensive to capture that. In a service-based organization, that might be a big number. I don't know whether it's important to users to categorize that number as if it's somehow a component of other long-term obligations. So if we can't figure out a way to separate day rents from other short-term leases, then I would not be supportive of including the disclosure requirement, and would agree with Larry. I also had a question, and maybe this we could deal with in drafting, but we've been talking about in our disclosure framework process how to provide an objective and potentially be less prescriptive about how to meet that requirement. So I'm going to be interested when we say, here are the quantitative disclosures, if it is, here's the objective, and in meeting that objective, at a minimum, you shall disclose all of the following, or whether this will be characterized as, here are disclosures that one should consider in meeting the objective. And perhaps we could deal with that in drafting, because I don't know that you've gotten to the point of, are these shall disclose versus shall consider to meet the objective. The other couple I had were, Danielle, you raised the non-cash disclosure for leases, and I'm fine if that's, as Mark suggests, A versus B. I would not support disclosing that in two locations. Of all things in the financial statements that would say must be disclosed and must be disclosed twice, this wouldn't rise to that level. And I frankly don't care whether somebody discloses it in the cash flow statement along with all other non-cash activity or discloses it in this table. I could make arguments either way. On one hand, you might say people want to see it with the leases. Another user might say, I want to see it along with all of the cash activity and other non-cash activity. So I would just say it needs to be disclosed once, could be disclosed here or there. And the last thing I had was whether or not we're going to, in the final standard, move away from A versus B to more descriptive terms. I understand in this memo it's done for probably simplification and the fact that we've always used those terms in redeliberation, but I wouldn't support continuing to use those as a way to distinguish between leases in the final standard.
Right. Your first comment on this short-term lease disclosure, so in existing GAAP, we say you only have to disclose anything longer than a month. Would that work for you, or you think we need to?
If we carried that forward, that would work for me.
Okay. And then, yeah, we'll need to think about whether we shall disclose all these or consider to meet the objective. On the non-cash disclosure, would you allow it to be a choice that anyone could decide? Do you want to put it with the, okay, so it wouldn't, we wouldn't prescribe one or the other, just it needs to be somewhere.
But you would split it by A and B?
I wouldn't be troubled by, okay. I'm not, it'd be helpful if I understood how that, I mean, Mark, you talked about it's important. Was it important to you to know between A versus B? I mean, if it was, I don't think it'd be that difficult. I just...
Well, I think, you know, the first breakout you have here is good, operating and financing. But am I right to think that the operating would include interest on A as well as straight-line payments on B? So I just think it conflates, you know, if you're trying to understand the liability changes, you would want to know that information.
Daryl? First of all, I agree with Larry's comment regarding the not prescribing the table. I think as long as the information is disclosed and understandable somewhere in the footnotes, it's okay, although I also agree that probably tabular disclosure seems to be the best, and it would all be in one place, but I don't know that we need to prescribe that. Secondly, I agree with Tom's comment regarding the labeling of the new and extension leases that come in. I think the emphasis of our model is on the liability side of things with the asset following. I think also by labeling it to be, you know, something along the lines of new liabilities acquired, it ties in with the discussion in paragraph 58 of our memo. With regard to breaking everything down by A versus B, you know, to the extent that is useful, I think we should try to provide it. It seems to me that based on the discussion and the outreach that we've done, that that shouldn't be much more costly for preparers to do, and so it seems if that's the case and it's useful, then perhaps the breakdown of almost all the things would be appropriate. Lastly, I wanted to ask a little bit about the requirement to disclose the average remaining lease term. And in terms of asking about what's the primary usefulness of that information, because when I think about that, and again, I'm thinking of it in terms of the next question too, sort of the trading off of the maturity analysis removal. If I think about average remaining lease term, if I know the cash flows and then I know that, then I could estimate a liability. But we're already requiring a liability to be booked, so it seems like that's probably not the benefit we're searching for here. I guess another benefit could be just to understand how soon are the leases going to expire and have to be renewed or replaced. Maybe that's a benefit. In terms of if we're trying to use the information to estimate some cash flows, it seems to me that the maturity analysis would better and more directly do that. So maybe can the staff explain a little bit about what the usefulness is intended to be of this number?
Well, our initial thing on the weighted average remaining lease term, I'll just note that, you know, it's important to understand that this was requested by users, so it wasn't an invention of the staff. Our understanding, and you and I talked a little bit on this yesterday, Shandy, I'll ask you to clarify whatever I don't get quite right here, but the notion is that to some extent today we have users that make different adjustments. We talked about the 6x or 8x rough approximation from a rent expense number. It is our view that for those entities, particularly equity analysts, that are going to try and compare the owner to the lessee, that this would give them a better approximation. Given the combination of things like the discount rate and the lease liability that we will disclose or present separately that they will have, combined with the weighted average remaining lease term, they're going to be able to much more approximate. You know, if they think, well, let's see, I've got a weighted average lease term of 5 years, but I know that the average life of that asset is basically 10 years, or I know they're going to need this asset for the next 10 years, I can use that to approximate what do I think the real lease liability is that I should put into my leverage analysis at a far better level than kind of the swag that gets done today. So to your point that it wasn't necessarily that this was a replacement for the maturity analysis, it was the notion that this was going to serve the effort of providing better knowledge of renewal risk, a better way to approximate a whole asset number, And it just so happened that because we were doing this, we thought that then you could approximate what was going to happen in the maturity analysis. It wasn't the opposite direction.
Okay.
The only other thing I want to note, when you mentioned the, you know, the small asset, short-term lease expense, you know, it reminds me a little bit of the discussion we're having, where we're probably going to have some. You know, the first question of a lease's TRG might be, you know, do I have to prove the materiality of the day rate leases that I'm not proposing? So here in the U.S. in particular, given certain things that a number of us have heard recently, that might not, you know, I think the staff acknowledged that might not be that might be a necessary evil in the U.S. The other notion is that I would just suggest, before we would, for example, vote on, to your point, Jim, about the shale versus consider, I worry a little bit about, you know, are we able to apply the judgment to determine when, you know, if I say I should consider putting in these disclosures, the question we're going to get is, well, what factors tell me that I should end up on yes, and what factors should end up on no? I think in general it might be something to the extent of what Mark pointed out going in the basis earlier, is that, you know, we're not asking you to put in disclosures that just aren't going to matter, but I think we always envision these as somewhat a mandatory package of disclosures unless they were immaterial.
And Scott, if I understand the maturity table correctly, it's years one through five, and then a lump sum. So you don't know if that lump sum is in the sixth year or the 20th year. So this number gives you a much better sense of what's remaining, more so than the maturity table would. However, the maturity table provides you some really good information that's not captured in this number for the next 5 years. So, you know, I actually see the two working in concert with one another. You could argue which one's more important. Well, it depends on how you do your analysis. But I think, unfortunately, the way we've got the maturity set up, you need both information. You know, you need both pieces of information.
So before I call a vote, a couple of questions. One is, is it fair to say this in Jim's question about shall versus consider, because you've phrased the question require, that your recommendation is in essence a shall?
I mean, I guess that's how I think we took it. I think there's even one spot in the ISB paper, or maybe it was in Catherine's stamp. I think, Petrina, correct me if I'm wrong, but they talk about, you know, we will start with a series of mandatory quantitative disclosures, and then.
So then the debate about should we split out all A from B, is that in essence, can that be covered by the board's conclusion in paragraph 37, which was don't aggregate, or get the right mix between aggregation and disaggregation. So if the company believes splitting A and B was relevant, would they be required to do it under how we voted in 37? They wouldn't be prohibited from doing it, but would they be required?
I don't think that's the way it would be interpreted.
No,
if we required it on a combined basis and included the statement about aggregation, disaggregation, or whatever, I believe that most people would say on an aggregated basis is just fine.
Okay. Okay, so here I've tried to list out every observations from board members. So the first question I focused on are just the rows, and then from there we'll focus on the split. Okay, so the first point I heard raised was whether or not there should be a requirement for short-term leases. So I'm going to call a vote about do we want to adjust that requirement such that it is similar today, meaning short-term leases for this disclosure would be defined as leases greater than a month and less than a year, versus deleting that potential requirement. Okay, so who would be supportive of requiring a disclosure of short-term leases that would be defined as between 30 days and 1 year? That's five, okay, and Larry would want to delete it. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about is the label of the row, which is right now for the staff records labeled ROU assets obtained in exchange for lease liabilities. So I'm going to call a vote of who wants to keep that label versus change the label. And these words aren't going to be exact, but basically the label would describe that the asset is derived directly from the liability. So subject to drafting, it would be labeled something like, can't find it now.
Leases commencing or being extended.
Yeah. liabilities created due to lease commitments and extensions for this period. So who would be supportive of changing it to something where it appears the asset is directly derived from the liability? Okay, so that's six with Tom seven. Now let's talk about, I know some of you had said that you want to require the split of all rows between A and B. I'm going to ask that question. If I don't have a majority of that, then I'll talk about the individual items that you might want to separate. So who would want to have a separate depiction for all leases between A and B? So the reason I raise it is Hal and Tom have that as they want all. I think some of us don't want all. Some of us might want more split out than what the staff's recommendation. That's why I'm doing it this way. So that's two that want to split out. So you get a revote when we go to these other questions. You're not okay. All right. And I'm just going to count Tom. Tom did not answer his question, but I'm going to presume because he wanted to split out all, he probably wouldn't object to splitting individual rows.
You weren't in Tom's small group meeting. I think he understood. I don't want to completely speak for him, but I think he understood our point on, one, there is no A and B for short-term lease expense, so there would be no split there. and variable lease expense, we had the same discussion we had
there
here.
There can be.
There could be, but the discussion we had about why that would be incredibly difficult for companies, he
was okay. Aware all right, of all right. Okay. So what I've, and I'm happy to put more on, what I've heard is board members raising a split on variable leases between A and B, separating cash flow between A and B, and separating, I have non-cash.
Yeah, the ROU asset.
The ROU asset between A and B. Okay, is there anything else you want to talk about splitting between A and B? You talk about discount rate. You want to put that?
He wants it for A.
A and B are averages. No, I was adding A just to complete the table.
Okay. So who wants to split variable leases between A and B? Okay, so who wants to separate cash flows between A and B? So that's three. Who wants to separate non-cash flows between A and B? So that's really, okay, that's six. All right.
Six.
Did you count Tom in that first?
Cash flow.
I counted Tom and all of those.
Mark, Tom, Mark, Larry, myself.
For the last one?
No, the next cash to the last flows. One.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed you. You want to do cash flows by MB? Okay, so that's four. Sorry, I didn't see that. Okay. All right, so that seems like we would require a split of cash flows by AMB and non-cash, which is the link of the liability between A and B. So now we've had a lot of discussion about, do we want to require a table? Do we want to be silent and put an example that has the table? Yeah?
Hal's question about whether we want to require weighted average discount rate for A.
Oh, okay. All right. Who wants to do that? One, two. All right. Three.
Is there any...
Can I ask why we would do that? We don't
do
that for debt.
I would say that it's probably not prohibitively difficult to do, but our view when we were developing this is it is something additionally you'd have to do when we weren't sure of the value, because yes, it is an approximation, but we did it. I mean, you can approximate what your discount rate is, and it serves less of a purpose, because the primary reason people want the weighted average for type B is for those users that want to split interest and amortization, and for type A we're giving them the actual dollar amount, so it just seems like it has less value. I'm not saying it has no value, but it was just a cost-benefit judgment on the part of the staff.
I didn't feel strongly one way or the other. I just looked at this set of data, and it sort of jumped out at you. Why do I know the weighted average discount rate for one type, and I don't know the weighted average? I don't know how people exactly would use it. It just would tell them one thing, we don't tell them the other. Why?
Yeah. And I'm looking at it as change over time. It's going to tell me something about the liability. But my first observation was a completeness. What? I got three out of four numbers that seem relevant here. Why not the fourth? I can compute it. Right? No, I can't compute it. I can ballpark
it. Guess it.
I can ballpark it. So.
I looked at it very differently, looking at the type A as being more akin to a long-term debt, and I don't think we require that type of disclosure for long-term debt.
So here's what I want you to do. Since we're 3-3 and it's not fair debt, I don't know where Tom is on this. Ask Tom when he returns, and then bring it back as a sweep issue. So no, we're not going to hold it up. Okay. I mean, if Tom does not want to do it, we can do, but if Tom wants to do it, we'd bring him back. Be fair. Okay, with respect to the table, I know the staff's recommending a table. I know other board members have observed they would rather not require a table, but rather put it as an example disclosure, a table. Right? Okay, so who would prefer the latter, which is we would not require a table, we would rather hint as to, in an example, that the table would be a...
Strongly hint, but yes.
One way of doing it. Hold on, I got it. Let me see. Tom says he prefers separate tables, so I'm going to go with that. He wants a table. So who would be okay with using the table as an example? So that's five. Okay, so we'll go five on that.
The only other issue was the total lease expense, and they were going to work on some wording and making that more clear, because the total lease expense suggested it ties to the income statement.
Okay, so I think that would be a good description in the basis of how we arrived at this and why we felt this needed to be, because you couldn't derive total lease expense from the performance statement for various reasons, and that's the basis for doing a disclosure of total lease expense.
It's just an oddity of calling it expense when it doesn't. It's not really expense. It could be so amounts could be capitalized in inventory. We're not saying you have to back that
right
out.
Also,
you don't want to label it lease expense?
No, because I think it's misleading.
Okay. All right, sorry, I misunderstood your point. But
your point is a fair one as well. It's pulling it all together, and that's why the table is important. But.
Okay, so
I guess just to be clear, if you look at question six, that total category that we did more or less for, that total bolded line, total lease expense, isn't actually one of the items A through J. I think we kind of did that ourselves, but weren't actually asking you to vote on it. If you want to tell us that the table should not include a total, because I agree with what you're saying. I know what you're saying is the reason we are trying to just show what it sum total to is because that's the number that a user might say, oop, there it is, times eight, if that's what they still want to do. So we can call it something, total lease cost, or we don't have to do a total whatsoever. They can do their own math. But it wasn't actually one of the specific items we actually talked about whether to include that or not.
My preference would be called total lease cost and just stop.
How different is that number going to be from, because now we're breaking out, refresh my memory, on the vote for cash flows?
Yeah, that's 4-3, so we'd separate.
Yeah, so how different is that going to be other than those leases that aren't paid on a straight line basis?
That's going to be your adjustment, basically.
Come up with something. I mean, I think it's an essence driver. I think your point's valid, and we aren't really describing a total lease expense. We're describing something else. So lease costs.
Well, I guess my real question is, if we break out Type B cash lease payments,
right,
does a user really need any more? Why would we require? Why don't we just delete the Type B lease expense line? Why do we need it?
The Type B lease line isn't just going to be cash paid, obviously. The lease expense is not going to equal the cash flow if you prepay or, it's straight line versus... I don't know what the terms of the lease.
It seems to me it's the if the objective of our lease disclosure is talking about timing, uncertainty, and amount of cash flows, and we disclose the amount of cash flows, it seems to me we've accomplished the objective.
Well, I suppose when it's substantially different, the reason you'd want to know is to be able to adjust the earnings because the accrual earnings are different than the cash earnings. So the cash number gives you that. And that's why you have a cash flow statement. We'll deal with that in drafting, and let's turn over to the ISB to talk about their question, and then we'll go back to question three, question five.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to tee up the quantitative disclosure table recommendations in Agenda Paper 3B for the IASB. Having said that, we discussed these recommendations in quite a bit of detail during yesterday's education session, and in addition, a number of the items in that table have already been described by Danielle. So in the interest of not repeating information that board members have already heard, I'm not proposing to talk through each item in the table. Instead, what I'd like to do is use this tee-up to provide a bit more around the staff thinking on three particular items that were raised yesterday during the education session that we either have additional comments and clarifications on, or in one case where we'd like to propose a slight amendment to what is in the paper. In talking through these three things, it might be helpful if the board members could have paragraph 51 in front of them, which is the example table from the board paper. So the first of the three items that I'd like to mention relates to concerns that were raised around the inclusion of subtotals in that table. Before getting into that, I would like to preempt this with the fact that we understand the board members might want the same discussion that the FASB just had regarding mandating the table at all, and clarify that our staff recommendation remains that we think that that table is very worthwhile and we'd recommend it. So everything I'm about to say is on the basis that we do continue to recommend that table, but we understand that discussion might be happening. So given that the table is in, the first thing we want to talk about is that yesterday some concerns were raised about the inclusion of subtotals in that table. And in particular, that related to the total lease expense line that appears. And it also related to the subtotal which summed amortisation and interest, i.e. the 1370 number in the table. Concerns that were expressed were that those subtotals in themselves didn't represent meaningful income statement items. And there were worries about how the inclusion of that subtotal would be affected in the event that any individual line items were concluded to be immaterial. So in the light of those concerns, and on further consideration following yesterday's discussions, we'd like to clarify that we don't propose including those subtotals in any requirements or examples that might appear in the final leases standard. We don't intend to prohibit the inclusion of those subtotals if preparers would like to include them, but we will make sure in drafting that we don't give any suggestion that they're mandatory. For the avoidance of doubt, what we're saying now doesn't in any way affect the questions or recommendations in the paper, but we do understand the concerns that were raised yesterday and want to clarify to the board members that we won't, in drafting, give any indication that subtotals within a table are something that we consider to be required. So moving on to the second of the three points. A question was raised yesterday about sublease income, and in particular the fact that an entity whose primary business activities involve leasing, for them sublease income might constitute revenue. So on this point, we'd firstly like to clarify that when we wrote that table, we had in mind what I'll refer to as normal lessees, and that's as opposed to those for whom sublease income constitutes revenue. We agree with the concern that was raised yesterday, and whilst we don't propose changing any of the recommendations in the paper in that regard, we would like to note that within the drafting process, we'll make sure that we make it clear that the presentation of sublease income in that table would not be expected to include that which constituted revenue. So that's another clarification following yesterday. The third and final point that we'd like to talk about relates to our recommendation that a lessee should be required to disclose a split of their total lease expense by class of assets. In light of the discussions yesterday and on further consideration, we'd like to propose a slight amendment to that recommendation as it's described in the paper. And I'll explain this proposal with reference to the table in paragraph 51. So you'll see in the table that that proposal for a split by class of asset is over the total of interest and amortisation, i.e. the split is of the 1370 number that appears in the table. We'd now like to suggest that instead that split be required only for the amortisation expense. So that means instead of breaking down the 1370 by, as it's presented in the table, property and other classes, we would instead break down the 1006, that is the first line, and represent just the amortisation expense. In explaining why we'd like to suggest that, I'd firstly like to very quickly reiterate why we think expense information by class of asset is important to include. So equity analysts have reported that that information is useful in enabling them to work out whole asset information. And they do this by multiplying the annual lease expense by class of asset based on an estimate they'd make of the typical economic life of a certain class. But that calculation would, of course, be adjusted for any interest element of the lease expense. So the alternative that we're now proposing, which is to provide the split only for the amortisation expense and not for amortisation plus interest, is on the basis that we think, firstly, it could be less costly because the interest expense won't need to be split in that way. And secondly, we don't think that it will hinder the analysis that that number is used for, because that analysis would in any event be adjusted for the interest component to be taken out. So with those three clarifications, I will hand over back to the board for discussion. If there are any lines you would like our thoughts on, do let us know.
Darryl?
I like the last change you made. I think it does make sense, and I'll explain a little bit why it also makes sense, I think, in the bigger way that I would look at this. I think the starting point for me is I disagree with the table. I disagree with the concept of the table, and I do that because I think the thrust of the decisions we've taken up to this point in the leases discussion is to say that leases aren't special. Leases is simply another mechanism by which a company acquires an asset, in this case a right-of-use asset, and funds that acquisition through funding from a third party, in this case the lessor. If leases aren't special, it seems to me that we then should be treating the assets that arise through a lease the same way as we treat other assets, and we should treat the liabilities that arise from a lease the way we treat other liabilities. Now, in some circumstances where leases are incidental, maybe it makes sense to put these in the table, but in many other circumstances, I would think it would make more sense to bundle the assets with the other assets and the liabilities with the other liabilities. And I think that would provide, in many cases, and I think of airlines now who choose between buying and leasing on an ongoing basis, it seems to me that would provide much more relevant information. And it's not just the on-balance sheet stuff, because the interest would be the same, the amortization would be the same. The split of classes of assets, it seems to me, should follow the same sort of pattern. So I would have supported that approach. That means I'm even a little bit nervous about using the example of the table, because very often our examples steer people in a particular direction. And I think the whole point of our disclosure initiative is to say we want people to provide useful information, however or whatever format that may be. So I would steer completely away from the table. That also informs some of the other decisions and things we've talked about. So when you talk about a reconciliation of liabilities, I would support treating our liabilities the same way as we treat other liabilities of equivalent term, duration, contractual, and etc. That means right now we don't require reconciliation, we may in the future. Right now we do require certain information. We do require maturity analysis and etc. In terms of the third point you made about the assets, under property, plant and equipment assets, we require something of a reconciliation. We require the depreciation information, require assets acquired and disposed of. That to me is equally useful in this space. So I would look to take all of the disclosures and say that ideally the liability, interest, amortization, asset disclosure should be as closely aligned as possible to others, and we should at least allow people to put them in the same place and treat them the same way.
Okay. Can we give a few thoughts on those? Firstly, I'll just briefly reiterate something that I think Scott mentioned, that the underlying reason for the proposal of the table is entirely based on the feedback that we've had from users, that one of the difficulties they have is trying to pull information from all different notes to get a complete picture of leasing, and they are very keen on being able to go to one place in the financial statements and go, here is what I need to know about the entity's leases. So that's the basis of that recommendation. I'd also like to comment a bit on your thoughts regarding lease liabilities are liabilities and right of use assets are assets. Again, all of our recommendations are entirely based on the feedback that we've had. And one of the biggest elements of the feedback we've had, and I'll talk first about assets, is that preparers have very consistently told us that it's extremely costly for them to produce reconciliations. And I think that is particularly true with regard to assets for many reasons, but it includes the fact that assets are managed sort of locally in an operational way quite often, and pulling the reconciliations together is a process that can be very costly. So given that investors have also told us it's not the reconciliations themselves they like, it's specific items, we do think that we're talking about a set of disclosures here that is less costly and more useful. We do understand that that is inconsistent with the fact that for PPE and other non-current assets, IFRS does require a reconciliation, but on the basis of the feedback we've received, we think that the alternative is more useful and less costly, and therefore, you know, we are quite strongly in support of our recommendation there. With regard to liabilities, the same applies in that preparers have told us that a reconciliation would be costly. I think with that, we actually have the difficulty that the proposals for IAS 7 are at the ED stage, and therefore with the two projects running concurrently, it's hard for us to say that the information investors have told us is useful from those reconciliations would be given by any currently required disclosures for all liabilities, and therefore what we've proposed here is what we think is the best balance of making sure the useful information is there in the least costly way. So that's a bit of support for.
So I think I sort of understand where we are on the liabilities, because as you say, we're still developing that reconciliation guidance. So I'd be comfortable with that one, subject to the fact that the ideal outcome is that if we decide at some future date that a reconciliation for liabilities makes sense, this is simply another liability and would presumably form part of that decision, which I think is appropriate. So I wouldn't want to anticipate that by doing something different for leases to the others. In regard to table, I think one issue, and I don't see any problem with for example, cross-referencing and stuff like that. I think when people talk about wanting all of the lease information together, at least a part of the driver for thinking that way was the need to reconstitute the information, to put together what the assets are, to put together what the liabilities are. Right now, we're asking that information. That's part of the actual measurement approach that we're taking. And it just seems to me that we're ending up with a model where we've actually changed leases from being something special to now being part of the normal process, and hence I would rather go that. I would prefer to see it go that way.
Steve?
Could I just add to what Daryl said? Because I was going to make the same point as your final point, that when we're asking people what information they need, that is it possible they're thinking in the old model? And they had to reconstruct things, and they had to make up the liability, and they had to do all sorts of things. But now we're going to give it all to them. And are these different assets and are these different liabilities that should be totally segregated and put separately, or should they be combined? I think that's a very important basic question, and I tend to agree with Daryl.
Steve?
I agree with Daryl as well, strongly, and I agree with Ian. You want to jump in?
Can I?
Yeah.
I obviously absolutely agree with this idea that we're now talking about right of use assets and liabilities, and we think that that makes things very normal. And so I do agree with that. But I wonder whether some of the leases are still different in that they give rise to different risks. So you can have access to very important assets, but you're not the owner, and so you do get exposure to other risks that are still special, like renewal risk and things like that, and part of what's coming through in this table is that. Also, I think that along the way we've made quite a few decisions to try and simplify things that help preparers but have had consequences for users. So for example, on the measurement side of things, we've done a sort of truncated and simplified version of measurement where we've taken out some aspects of the lease payments from the measurement of the liability, rightly I think, but we have, for example, taken out variable lease payments that aren't part of the liability measurement. We've scoped out short-term leases to try and assist preparers in terms of the burden. And so I think that even though we have normalised a lot of things, we've also introduced some special things. And so I wonder whether that still creates some differences of information that are partly because there's a different risk when you enter into a lease than owning an asset for all leases. And there's special things we've done to measurement and scope to assist with preparers that means that it is helpful for users to be able to sit and see all of this information in one place. And also, I guess, just while I'm talking, the other thing is that in the disclosure project generally, and in this context specifically, I think we get two messages all the time, which to me I find quite hard to reconcile. One is we get a very strong message a lot, which I completely agree with conceptually, that financial statements and the financial reports are all about communication and people should be given objectives and then left to deal with it the best they can. But on the other hand, a lot of the time when we talk to users of financial statements, they talk to us about, firstly, how tabular formats generally, not the content, but tabular formats as a concept are really helpful. And when they get the pen, so if you look at the EDTF, for example, where they've got much more influence than they do in sort of normal process, they immediately start doing template tables because they like the comparability that comes from it. So that makes me sort of...
So I suppose 2 points for me. I think the first thing is some of the risks that we think we've created, especially in environment leases, is actually similar in assets. Asset that's got 1 year to go before it actually is no longer useful has a renewal risk. You have to buy a new asset at the end of that period. So you've got that same kind of concept coming in there. We know that most users don't account for small assets. They expense them immediately. We know that many users wouldn't account for an asset that's only expected to be on, in fact, I think this might be a requirement, that they expect to have for less than a year. So in many cases, I think a lot of the things are similar. I agree with the table, and I think the actual table-type disclosure, so requiring a tabular format, mm-hmm. is very useful. My main problem with the format is that it's all in one place, where I think it would actually be a lot more useful, group like with like in other places.
Hans, can I finish?
Yes.
Sue's pretty much said the other half of what I was going to say. So I agree with Daryl that the right of use assets, I think we should have the same disclosures as IFRS 16, and I think the liabilities, we should have the same disclosures as IFRS 7, but that we should take note of what's special about leases, the variable lease payments, the short term, maybe the renewal risk, although I think I'm more agreeing with Daryl on that. And I am concerned about the table because it kind of perpetuates it's special. Mm. And I'm glad that you've taken away the subtotal. I think that's an improvement. But I just wonder whether we're trying to make too much of the disclosures here, whereas it should really be tied in to other things. I think mandating the table is wrong. What Daryl said, I think additions to right of use assets is much better placed with additions to fixed assets. I think it relates much better to that than it does within a leasing table, for example. A short comment as a result.
So what is your overall recommendation, Steve?
Well, I think a lot of what we have here is consistent with 16 and 7. So I don't fundamentally object to this, except perhaps the table, mandating the table, except the subtotals. I wouldn't go further in this table than we have in other places. So the weighted average remaining lease term, if we haven't got that for other liabilities, I don't think we should put it in here. If we think it's relevant, we should consider it for all liabilities, although we've got the maturity analysis instead. We might want to think about the cost-benefit side of the fixed asset roll forward for leases versus other assets. I could be persuaded that we shouldn't require it for leases on a cost-benefit test compared with other assets, although personally I think we should consider it for all fixed assets and how we account for those assets and whether we should have that roll forward. Because I agree with you about the cost-benefit of assessment of assets which, where the records are held locally, and the difficulty that preparers have in preparing that.
Rigo?
As Daryl and Steve, I strongly against to require such a table for the following reasons. Firstly, you know, we quite often heard the users' request to put everything together. But think about all of our standards, you know, we have now 4 days or 6 days, and they want to put everything together, and then you can see a lot of duplications among different kind of requirements. And in this case, Daryl and Steve already mentioned, you know, they duplicate with the PPE and liabilities and expenses. many of the company may lease expenses part of the general expenses. So I never liked the idea called one place. Of course, for a particular entity, maybe they will put one major transaction as a, in one case because of their specific environment. As a general requirement, I don't like it. And secondly, I think this idea is totally against our recent discussions in the conceptual framework and the disclosure initiative. And both of these projects try to you know, have a principle, you know, which, you know, so just mentioned that, you know, people are struggling, you know, whether entity specific or uniformity is struggling. But basically, I think if we do so, actually, against the principles we are trying to generate. And certainly, I'm quite trying to think about, you know, normally, disclosure will be ordered based on the basic financial statements. Normally, you know, normally. But if, you know, you mix these things, I don't know how the company can do. And yesterday during the education meetings, I already asked, if we even require such a table, then the company still need to do a supplementary notes to all these items. Then where the items will go? You know, the first one, let's assume, relate to PPE. Should the notes to this table or notes be part of the PPE notes or the other items the same? So I, for these reasons, I will not support the ideas.
Martin?
Yeah. I support this idea of this table because I think it is really comprehensive, and I think leasing is special, and therefore we have a separate standard, and to have this disclosure in one place in tabular form, I really think it's a good idea, and we should require that from the preparers to do that. Secondly, I think it was what you said regarding yesterday, I had some concerns regarding the split of lease expense by asset type. I think now staff is recommending that it is only when required by the amortization. I think that is really an improvement. I really don't understand because when we require it by asset type, but the FASB not. And I'm wondering if really users in the US maybe have different kind of models to estimate that, because why are users from our standards needed by asset type, and in the US maybe they is efficient that it is by the overall expense. So I really don't understand why that is different, and I would recommend really that we should delete that, and I think it is sufficient to have it in one line because now we have leases on balance sheet, and I think this topic is not so important as it was in the past. Thirdly, I think what the FASB discussed regarding this short-term lease expense, I think we should also introduce it should be then leases which is longer than 30 days, because then we can avoid all this kind of taxi hotel rooms and this kind of stuff. Thanks.
Catherine, do you want to address that second issue?
Yeah, we can give a comment on that. So where you were talking about the fact that we have a difference from the FASB recommendation with regard to the split by class that users tell us they use to estimate whole asset information. I would, to a point, attribute that to the fact that effectively today, so under the ED we proposed the two reconciliations of both liabilities and assets, whereas the FASB had only proposed liabilities because they don't generally require these asset reconciliations. So previously what we had proposed would have disclosed expenses by class, and that is what it would have been used for. Now I can't say, you know, with 100% certainty that is why investors are saying this to us, because I think generally they think it is useful to be able to estimate whole asset information, and that's the best way of doing it. But in terms of there being a difference, I'd say we're keeping part of a bigger disclosure that we proposed in the ED that the FASB didn't, and that is the origin of why we're coming to different places.
Starting point.
Yeah, because we've effectively got different precedent in terms of assets.
But the purpose is the same, I think. Also, they require the disclosure maybe to really come up with an estimate of whole asset information, and that is also our main purpose of this disclosure. And that is why I'm wondering, because my wine estimation is impossible with the information which is sent on the total expense, and we need kind of split. Maybe you come up with a better estimate, but what I'm challenging is really how better really this estimation is when compared to what kind of cost preparers have to come up with this split. Therefore, I would recommend now to have the overall number, because in addition, I think, was compared to what is current situation, we have all these assets on the balance sheet, and I think this overall story, to compare it with the purchase of asset, is maybe not so important as it was in the past, because we bring it in now, these assets on the balance sheet.
Amaru?
Makes sense. I agree with Martin that leases are special, and that's why we are having a standard on lease, and we have one present standard. So with that part, I agree, but I disagree with the table. I think it's too prescriptive. I think I'm generally okay with content, but content based in a sound principle, but not to prescribe a format. So with contents, I'm generally okay, but not with the format. And I have one question, considering what you said. I'm struggling with the benefit of the weight average remaining lease term. So no one mentioned this during the discussion about the content, but I'm still struggling. What's the meaning of this if we are not splitting by class? I don't think it's really useful to have only weight average of computers or laptops and buildings and cars. So what do you have in mind for this?
So with that, the reason that we were proposing it is because we have been told by users that is useful in assessing renewal risk, so to speak. So it allows them to assess how long could businesses continue without having to renew all of their leases. But we did discuss yesterday the interaction between that disclosure and the maturity analysis. And I know that the FASB touched on this. It is perhaps slightly different for the IASB in that we are proposing a maturity analysis in accordance with IFRS 7 that permits entities to use judgment as to the bookings. So it wouldn't be as restrictive as you only get the first 5 years and then one number. It is possible that you would get more information than that where it's relevant. So yesterday we did sort of talk about the fact that you can get a certain amount of the same information from the maturity analysis. And on balance, based on the feedback we've had, we thought that the weighted average term was also useful, but we do understand there is a cost-benefit assessment there, and it might be that the decision went the other way.
Yeah, I disagree. I don't think it's really useful in a single number. Mm. So I would exclude from any suggested disclosure. And also one note, I heard some mentioning that shall as a minimum, things like that to disclosure. I would definitely avoid using expressions such as minimum, because this creates lots of problems in terms of disclosure. So I would base in a sound principle, mention aspects that should, or components that should be considered to be disclosed, applying the general principle of materiality that's applied throughout the standards that we have, and also the level of I forgot the word, but level, I talked to Patrina. So the
aggregation and disaggregation
that we have already in IS1, so it's aligned with the aggregation disaggregation that you have to use in this paper.
I mean, just to touch on your last point, Amara, I think you're right. I mean, I think you're right to say we don't need to add words like as a minimum. Yeah. In any event, I think that the amendments that have just been made to IS1 are probably really helpful in this respect, because they very clearly articulate sort of aggregation and disaggregation. They also just make clear that even where a standard says there's a list of mandatory shall requirements, obviously you apply materiality, and that is so to the extent that any of those shall requirements are immaterial, even where the standard states it as a minimum, you obviously look through that and apply proper materiality. So
Gary?
Thank you. Just before I begin, I think we'll compliment both staffs for well-written papers that were maybe lengthy but still easy to get through. Several comments, but let me begin with something Daryl said, and I think a few others, that we'd like to treat leases as normal, whether it's normal assets or normal long-term liabilities or whatever. And I agree with that, but I don't think we're at that point right now. It this is going to be new in the world. And looking back over a lot of years as a preparer, you know, expensing stock options was new, you know, at one point in time, controversial, sometimes big numbers, and the U.S. is expensing 20 years ago retiree health costs as opposed to cash basis. There's a few other, call it fundamental changes in standards. And so the history of what happened when these things were first launched, lots of special disclosures and the footnotes, the MD&A and stuff, but eventually they became normal. In time and just sort of morphed into the larger body of disclosures with nothing special attached to them. But I think for the first periods of time that this is effective, it's going to get some forms of special treatment. So I think some sort of prominence in the disclosures makes a lot of sense. And I think this would almost be a perfect subject for a post-implementation review. Has it achieved its purpose? Is it absorbed and assimilated, and therefore you don't necessarily need all that stuff? I do agree with not mandating the table. I think it's, like Jim Croker said, I think it's highly efficient and perhaps recommended, you know, I don't think it's required. I think it flies right in the face of IAS-1 trying to give flexibility in preparing the financial statements. And since that's literally fresh off the press, I don't think we want to come up with something that's in conflict with that right away. I think the suggestion from Norwalk about the one-month rule, I think, makes perfect sense. It gets a lot of clutter and noise out of the system. You know, when you travel, you don't think of renting a car and renting a hotel room as a lease. You think of it as a travel and entertainment expense or something like that. So I would highly suggest we put that in the standard as well. And I think we'll solve, presumably with the other IAS, I think, 7 disclosure proposals about the role for the leasing liability. And I guess it remains to be seen if that sticks, but I'm assuming it will. I think it solves that particular concern. Thank you.
Philippe?
Yeah, thanks. Well, in terms of contents of this table, like Amaro, I remain very unconvinced after yesterday's and today's discussion about the usefulness of the weighted average. It's a mixture of different types of assets, of different types of leases. Some are short-term, some are long-term. How do you do the weighted? Do you take into account the short-term leases in that weighted average or not, or just the ones which are recognized? It doesn't mean anything. I mean, in terms of giving an indication of the degree of flexibility of the management in using assets, it doesn't help much. I think the maturity analysis, very much needed. This weighted average, costly to prepare. You have to aggregate all sorts of different data. It's not broken down by type of asset, so I don't really know what you can do with that, really. So I think, and because the FASB doesn't seem to think it is useful, I don't see why we would have more weight on that special element. Regarding the format, I believe that it is useful to have all the information in one single note for the reasons which have been explained by some others. Yes, it is a bit special. Lease contracts have different risks as opposed to other types of ways to finance an activity or to use assets. Now, when we have decided, just as proposed, to take off the subtotals, it's just a list, it's not a table. It becomes a list, an organized list. I don't call it a table, because the table has some subtotals which reconcile to something else. So just is an organized way to present information, to list that information, one single note, to put it in a box, why not? It might be more convenient for you, for preparers. I would not mandate it either. I think it's probably something some people might think it's more convenient for communicating, but I would have a hard time as an enforcer to take a preparer to some sanctioning or to a court just because information has been listed and not put in a table, really. Let's be serious about it.
But we often say in tabular format, in our standards, in our standards, we often say in tabular format.
Yeah, but I think that's when the alternative is words.
Yeah. And you also say unless another format is more appropriate. So you do have, it's not, I've just looked up IFRS 7.
Yes.
And it's, and yes. Just as far as I know, I can't say absolutely, but every time I've seen it, there's a qualifier that says unless another format is more appropriate.
But people could put this information in long sentences.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how accessible that is. Yeah. So often we do recommend tabular, well, at least recommend, okay, maybe,
recommend,
maybe
yes,
that.
Recommend.
Mm-hmm. And in hedge accounting, we did prescribe a single note that's everything in one table.
I'm not against the idea that we should encourage, saying it is usually more convenient, clearer to do it in a tabular format, but really to make it a standard that you can take people to court on that basis.
I think preparers will go to what's the most efficient and effective way. I think a lot of times it will be a table. If you've got a sizable book of leases, we just shouldn't require it. I think you'll naturally get there most of the time.
And I will have another point about what is missing from that table. What it might be that with when you talk about the qualitative disclosures, although it is more quantitative, it's about information regarding the discount rate used to discount significant amounts and the judgments made around selecting the discount rate. But I'll come back to it when we go to this qualitative disclosures.
Chung Wu?
Thank you. Generally, I agree with the format with the Philips and some others, you know, kind of flexible approach. And I would like to say thank you on this lease expense split by underlying asset type. Quick response from our discussion in education session. But we need to think about one more time this quick revision. Under the divergent model with the FASB and ISBs, I use this table, the property lease expense and others, as a kind of a proxy number estimates for the type B and type A lease expenses. Yeah, basically, so that's just my first use of these two tables, the numbers, because we don't have any kind of information about this difference between these two models. So I have used this kind of numbers, these two numbers, to identify the differences between the FASB model and the ISBA model. That's why I'm suggesting we need to think about whether we just simplify this lease expenses by asset type, only asking for the amortization expense. So.
Could I just clarify something?
Okay.
When we're talking about splitting things by class of asset, perhaps it's misleading in that we only put two things in the example. We weren't intending in any way for that to be a proxy of type A and type B. That's absolutely not what we're suggesting. And what we envisage when we're talking about class of asset is that description will be used in the same way that it is today used in PPE, in that preparers make a judgment about how to bucket their classes. So I just wanted to clarify. It's not intended to be an A-B split.
I understand perfectly, but coincidentally, if we classify that these expenses by property and some other, then we can guess, you know, some kind of tidy expenses. Then I guess this is the only place we can guess by the note disclosure. But you are not intending to disclose any information between these the differences. But coincidentally, we can have a very good information because of the original proposal by you. So that's why I'm thinking, you know, we need to reconsider whether we need a more simplification of the original proposal recommendation. That's what I'm suggesting.
That's true, as you say, that it's a good example, you should not do so.
Oh, yeah, but in another way, maybe.
Thank you. I have two comments and one small question. And the first one is about the tabular format. I strongly support staff's recommendation. I think it should be required. And I think this is not only for the investors or users, but also for the preparer side, as Philip or somebody pointed out. If you put yourself into the shoe of a CFO of 100,000, you know, subsidiary CFO of the company group with 100,000 subsidiaries, if we have this kind of requirement, then it would be much easier to collect the figure numbers and also lease has a different contract. So from the entry perspective, I mean, when you have a journal entry, you know it is going to be the table. So it makes the preparation much easier. That's why I support requiring one table. That's one thing. The second comment is about small asset lease expense. And I confirmed it in the education session. You confirmed that it must be disclosed only when it is material in aggregation basis. So if that is the case, I just want you to clarify it in your drafting so that constituents know that normally if it's a small asset item, then it shouldn't be disclosed because they are immaterial in general. So of course, it depends on the materiality, but you can exercise the materiality. And I'm confused with short-term leases. In the FASB's discussion, they said that it should be limited to the over the 1 month. But on the other hand, we have to make materiality judgment as well. So it confused me a little bit. So it sounds like you have to aggregate all the short-term lease expenses which exceeds 1 month. Yeah. Or can you make a judgment of materiality in the first place or not? I'm not quite clear on this point. Do you have any idea?
I think let me first of all clarify and then I'll clarify. I think what the reason the FASB were suggesting. So first of all, as we've made clear, and with everything to do with disclosure and what was clarified in IS1 is you're only required to disclose anything to the extent that it is material. And so to your point, for example, if we're now talking about the short-term lease expense, if when you add together everything that might be short-term leases and you look at that expense and that aggregate number is immaterial, you would not be required to disclose it. I think the reason the FASB and I think a couple of board members here said they supported that is that I picture that in pulling together all of the information about what are short-term leases and therefore what are the expenses, I think they're trying to provide relief to say, look, when you're pulling together that information to work out whether it's material in the aggregate or not, we're not going to expect you to search through and find.
It's sort of a small ticket exemption, isn't it?
Well, it's based on time. So it's basically saying I don't expect you to go through and pick out everything that possibly might meet the definition of a lease if it's only a lease for 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 days.
Clear. Thank you.
I don't know if that helps.
The last question is about the weighted average lease term. So it's a weighted average. So in order to calculate the weighted average, you have to basically include everything. Otherwise, you cannot calculate. But the question is, should we include short-term lease and the small asset items which are not material or not? I mean, those small ticket items are immaterial. And the short-term leases are immaterial. So do you have to include those terms as a calculation of average in the first place or not?
Our intention, perhaps it's not clear enough in the paper, is that disclosure and all the others would represent what is recognised on the balance sheet.
So recognised on the balance sheet. So in the first place, short-term lease is not recognised on the balance sheet. Okay. So therefore, it is not within the calculation of average. Okay,
yes,
clear.
That was our intention.
And small asset as well.
Is that true for cash paid as well?
No.
Does cash paid include short-term, material short-term and material small? It does include, yes, yeah, okay. Thank you. Like Sue, Tuck, and Martin, I am in complete agreement that we should prescribe, not permit, a table here. Not only have we been told to provide all this information in one place for at least 10 years, okay, we are trying to, other than recognize lease assets and liabilities on the balance sheet, that probably the most significant thing we're trying to do is communicate this new special form of accounting that is, in fact, going to be of great interest to many investors. By scattering it and making it disaggregated, you know, it's going to make it much more challenging. So I think, to the staff's point in paragraph 7, we're trying to be responsive to what we've heard in our outreach for several years. The reconciliation, my question is this. I'm, as I said yesterday, I'm not empathetic to excluding this as a requirement. What if we go down the path of requiring, in as an amendment to IS 7, a reconciliation? Would we, before we publish this document, would we consider amending this? Because at that point in time, if it's a requirement in IS 7, how do we reconcile with this? That's one question. Second question goes to an observation that Scott made in his TF, and maybe you can address, I mentioned this yesterday, and that is, what exactly are you going to put or describe in the standard around providing an explanation how the short-term expense number may not be representative of the true short-term obligation? If you can hum a few more bars about that and explain what you mean by that. Have we gotten to maturity analysis or table yet?
Not yet, no.
Okay, all right. Because I have some comments around that. But there were some observations that the FASB made, in particular Howe, which I thought were insightful, that couldn't be picked up by IFRS 7, i.e. IFRS 7 is not prescriptive in terms of bands. Mm-hmm. And people have been saying a disclosure of weighted average life is not going to be helpful. IFRS 7 doesn't necessarily prescribe whether or not you have to stop at 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. So if you follow that approach faithfully, coupled with a weighted average life, you actually have some very, very useful information. So perhaps our board members are overlooking that point when they think about what is the value of weighted average life. So I would include it. But to my two questions.
Maybe I'll come back. I'll take your second one first, and then when I forget what your first question is, you must remind me. But
the reconciliation.
Yeah. So just to pick up, and we will come back and talk about maturity analysis. And I agree with you. I think Hal made some good comments to show how having the maturity analysis as well as weighted average remaining lease term might be complementary. But I think Hal's point was missed. He was thinking about it was complementary, and in particular, it was complementary and added more in the context of where you're only going to get, you know, one lump sum figure for you know, on your maturity analysis table from, you know, year 6 forward, and therefore you had no information whatsoever about which year that was in. When we come forward to talk about the maturity analysis in IFRS 7, you could view it as being better or worse, in a sense, with something being more prescriptive. Where potentially, as you say, if I think applied, you know, if you take the disclosure in IFRS 7 and apply it to its intent of, you know, providing useful information where it's needed, I think that would at least say that people shouldn't just, you know, if they have a whole mixture, if they have, you know, 20, 30-year lease terms, I would think in that scenario it's incredibly useful to not just have a lump sum of all your payments from year 6 to year 25.
Can you make that clear in the standard
but
and the basis?
You would I mean, we can certainly describe it, but, you know, at least you should be breaking
right.
down that number. Now, that might say to you then, to kind of the comments that Hal was making, well, maybe there's actually less need to have the weighted average remaining lease term, because if I can get that more detailed breakdown in my maturity analysis, it means that I don't, you know, need to have this weighted average remaining lease term information.
Unfortunately, he won't be able to get it, though, because his standard won't prescribe it. It's not that saying that it won't happen, but his standard won't prescribe it, whereas it's possible under our standard, and I think we should just make it clear that if in fact you have 20-year leases, that it would be more faithfully represented that to have a table that would go out over that period of time, as opposed to stopping at year 5 and, you know, putting a lump sum thereafter.
Yeah, and we can come back to that on maturity. I think your first, what was your first question? I'm sorry, Patrick.
The reconciliation of the lease liability. We're not requiring.
Oh yeah.
But yet in another standard, we are going to require.
Thank you. Yeah. I suppose for me, and I'm just thinking about this now, is that I wouldn't think that if, you know, whatever, that we're going through now to take final decisions to go and produce a final standard. As I say, at the same time, yes, there is an exposure draft out now, and I have IS7 amendments. And I suppose I would view that, you know, we do need to keep track of timing, etc. But I would think that it's more the you know, that any requirements to have any kind of, you know, liability reconciliation around financial liabilities that, you know, would include leases, we would leave that to IS7. Either, you know, whether that would then be in IS7 or there would be consequential amendments to that to other standards. I would think we wouldn't come along and try to write that in the leases standard to then have it duplicated in IS7. So you know what I mean? As the project in IS7 moves forward, assuming it becomes a final standard, then the team working in that will work out drafting-wise whether that requirement would sit only in IFRS 7 but apply, you know, to leases as well as other financial, you know, instruments that are covered by IFRS 9, you know, IFRS 7, etc., or whether they would want to do consequential amendments across the other standards. But I think we wouldn't do that. We would leave that to be done via the IS7 work.
Yes, I just want to sort of summarise my thoughts. I've been listening carefully about whether we should have a table or not. I began with Darryl, and I think I'm still there. I was a little bit seduced by Gary with this is new, and but I still think it's overkill. I think it's a good idea, and I think we should suggest it but not prescribe it. That's where I sit, I think. The totals coming out, I think, is a big help, and it helps with some of the others. So if we haven't got the totals, if we haven't got total lease expense and that sort of item, is the information we're going to get on short-term lease expenses really useful? I mean, we're going to take a month of them out. Is it going to be a relevant figure? What's it going to tell us? I mean, we've left them out, and then we just want them to collect them and add them back in disclosures. And I'm just not sure it's going to give us a lot of information. I'm a little happier about small asset lease expenses, because if our theory is right, most that figure will usually be ruled out on materiality.
Yeah.
So the only time you'll have it is when it is material, and that will tell us whether our exemptions over a period of time been a good thing or a bad thing. And so I'm not so unhappy about that one. And I don't know if we're up to all these points yet, but I'll throw them in so I don't have to speak again. Gains on sale and leaseback, I think, is also a useless disclosure, and I'm hopeful we'll have far less sale and leaseback transactions because we'll have a liability on the balance sheet. The major reason for those transactions is to avoid the liability on the balance sheet. And I'm not sure. And then the weighted average life, I'm with people who don't agree with that.
Yeah, I agree with you on every point. Mary?
Ticking through a number of the items we've discussed, I support the recommendation that the FASB made about short-term lease expense disclosure applying only to those short-term leases that have a duration in excess of a month. And just to be clear, I don't think it's taking 1 month out of the amount, but it really is to get to certain types of transactions that technically might meet the definition of a lease from having to be considered or aggregated or addressed on a materiality basis. And actually, unlike Ian, I do find I'm inclined to say that is a good requirement to have, because this is, again, one of the things that we are exempting from of requiring lease accounting to be applied. And I think to give some quantification of what is going through I'll assume a non-accrual basis is helpful. In terms, second point, cash, the disclosure to require total cash flow for leases, I'd asked a question about this yesterday. I think it's drafting, but I think it would be very helpful in the drafting to be clear about what is captured and excluded from that amount. Kind of relates to some of Talk's questions about is it only recognized items or other items. I think it also would be helpful to have maybe some discussion of how the generic discussion of disaggregation might be considered in determining how much detail, how much breakout you have, you know, whether it's class of asset or otherwise, you know, in this table, rather than just kind of pointing and saying, remember, there's some disaggregation guides, or just assuming that people remember it. Going maybe to a couple of the bigger points, I think there are two issues with the table. One is whether we mandate or merely recommend it, and the second is a more basic point that came through in your feedback recap, which was that people wanted the information together. A table is just one way of putting it together, but that the users in particular were saying they wanted all the information about leasing in one point. And I agree with those who raised a concern that runs counter to the direction that we've been going in the IS1 amendments to confirm flexibility to enhance the usefulness of communication. I think in this case I have a split decision, which is I think we should mandate that the lease information be presented together. And you know, I'm not getting into the details of could you do that by including a cross-reference in this table to where it's presented elsewhere. You know, think about that. But I think what we've heard is people want the whole picture put together for them in one place. I think rather than mandating that they do that in a table, I think I'd pick up some of the language that Alan had cited earlier in a tabular format. And what was it?
Unless another is more appropriate.
You know, so a strong indication that's the direction to go. Bit of a hurdle for somebody to say this is why, you know, not in a disclosure, but to have to consider why they think something else is more relevant. And maybe that's how we illustrate it. Now, to Daryl's basic challenge to us, if the whole thrust of this project is to make leased assets and liabilities more like normal, why are we doing a special disclosure regime? I feel like we should be splitting the difference in terms of saying, let's start with what the normal requirements are. And any time we're thinking of varying them, to challenge ourselves to make sure we have, you know, very good evidence about why we are going to either omit, as you said, on the asset classifications, or add in another area. Are we sure that it's worth making a distinction? But I think that kind of goes with they're special enough that we had a strong message about keeping it in one place. Those two kind of interact. And so therefore, when you go back to the point that Pat raised about the interaction with our recent proposal to require a net debt reconciliation, and would that apply here, I think if we are going to mandate that it all be kept together, that we should be thinking about consequential amendment coming out of that project to this. And if we don't keep it together, then I think it's just apply the general requirement.
Can I just ask one question? On short-term lease, you said on a non-accrual basis. I don't think that's clear, is it? Well, that's a question to the staff, maybe. And then,
well, if you use the option to not apply the lease accounting model to short-term leases, then presumably they could be accounted for on a cash basis.
Well, it says short-term lease expense.
I think there we were, and what was proposed in the last ED, if I remember, if I can check, was that we would say for those alternatives, you actually kind of effectively apply operating lease accounting today. So you would recognize those on a typically straight line basis,
okay.
And the other lot of format is more representative.
I've not gone back and looked at it in a while, but I think I would want a quantification of what you recognized in respect of short-term leases that were not accounted for under the standard.
What about that thing that Pat called a dagger yesterday, and you go down and it says additional footnote disclosure to state short-term lease commitment if this isn't reflected in the short-term lease expense? I don't really understand.
I had a question about that, which I don't think Seth got a chance to answer.
I think your question was that you just wanted a bit more detail about what precisely we were suggesting.
What does that mean?
I suppose, sorry, not to interrupt Catherine, because maybe she has an answer, but I was going to say I could almost ask you that question only because, sorry, I don't mean to be pedantic, only to clarify that what we've got there around short term is only relating to decisions, you know, you made in March. So it's not something we got a lot of discussion on. But I think it is fair to ask the question now as to, you know, obviously what would we expect to be disclosed from that. And maybe Catherine, do you?
So the decision that was made in March was that in the event that the short term expense is not reflective of what short term payments are expected to be going forward, the board members decided that they wanted disclosure of what effectively the short term commitment would be. So you'd have the expense in the table, if in theory we had a table, but the additional disclosure was if that expense is not the same as what you expect your commitment to be for the next year, also disclose what lease payments under short-term leases are we committed to effectively in the next 12 months.
Just over the next 12 months.
It would automatically be over the next 12 months because they are short-term leases. I mean, that wasn't...
If they were longer than 12 months, then they wouldn't qualify as short-term leases.
So, well, but here's the thing. What if you enter into an arrangement where you have a lease that goes over 20 years with 20 break clauses over that 20-year period, mm-hmm. okay? Your commitment, okay, you could argue is 20 years. Legally, it's not. Legally, it's not, but you structured that way to accomplish that outcome.
I suppose I might say, I think, Patrick, that, you know, you're questioning potentially having the short-term lease exemption at
no,
all.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm questioning disclosure and what was really meant by that. In other words, am I going to get a sense as to all those arrangements that are potentially structured that way? I'm just going to get a sense as to those that...
Yes. Yeah, because commitment would be essentially the same as, you know, you'd have to have what is effectively a liability, but we're only not recognising it because it's short term. So anything that we wouldn't recognise as a liability, were it on the balance sheet, wouldn't be included in that.
Isn't it designed with quite a simple purpose, which is to give you an idea of what the usual annual commitment is from short term leases, because that's the one thing that's not on the balance sheet generally.
Okay, so how do we vote on all this?
I think we first need to vote on whether we have a table, is it?
I was going to say the
opposite. Or can we do it the other way?
let's
see what remains.
Yeah, I'm supposed to tell me, Catherine can correct me, here we are. I was going to suggest maybe that we take a vote on the actual disclosures on each item that at the moment is sitting in the table, and once we decide we agree on what we, you know, think the disclosure should be, then we come back and decide on whether we want to prescribe tabular format on one place or not.
So the staff recommendation was that the interest on lease liability would go, right?
No. So if we go down the table in paragraph 51 of paper 3B, so first of all, our only changes here. So first of all, maybe voting on separating, so having amortization expense and interest expense disclosed in the table.
All in favour?
All agree.
Yeah.
Secondly, and I will clarify this one because this is where our recommendation is changed, is that the recommendation to separate out the amortization expense by class of underlying asset.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
That's the changed recommendation. Yes. Maybe if we take then to have the short-term lease expense?
As modified by the first
FASB.
As modified.
So with the one-month exemption, yeah?
No.
Yes.
When Petrina respond to the Taka's questions, where the materiality adjustment first, assume you already assess materiality and kick out those immaterial items.
Then you ignore it completely.
Yeah, I don't think 1 month is necessary.
Well, you could have loads of two-day leases.
I think it is Wigwo, because the point isn't that the amounts are small, but the effort to capture a bunch of things that would, you know, are technically leases, let's say like a hotel room for one night, there would be a lot of effort involved in trying to capture those to assess their significance. So this is a different...
It's the same mechanism as the small ticket exemption. Yeah.
But only for a disclosure purpose.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why I like it very much.
Can I just ask?
Huh?
Can I ask a question on the short-term leases? And this footnote, as I'm still not clear. In addition to the expense for the year, you want the disclosure of next year's expense or the commitment at the balance sheet date for short-term leases which are still present at the balance sheet date, if that's different from the expense this year?
The decision that was made in March was the latter.
But won't it always be less than the expense under normal circumstances, unless you've taken on a massive lease at the end of the year? So it will always be different.
Under normal circumstances, we wouldn't expect it to need to be disclosed. It's if you've got
only if it's bigger than the annual expense.
If this year's number isn't representative of what you might expect next year, isn't that what you're trying to capture? Yes. I don't know.
That requires a forecast of what you expect next year, doesn't it?
A lot of work on each of those short-term leases.
If you have taken a commitment.
A lot of work.
Only if you have taken a commitment.
Could have thousands.
Yeah.
Should we ask the staff to bring it back as a sweep issue, actually, after, you know, because you said we discussed it a year ago. FASB also has the same, decision in there, rather than jumping on this.
Yeah. Okay.
We actually have the drafting of the words, if you'd like to look at it, in memo 3A, page 57. Paragraph 842-10-50-X, which is a draft of how we would envision that being. It would be a qualitative amount, not a quantitative amount, if you thought the short-term lease expense might be different in future years.
When committed, and only when committed. No.
And the amount?
And the amount.
I think the amount is of what your short-term commitment is today, and if you think it should be anything different, you would need to disclose that quantitatively. Qualitatively.
I think just a little history just to remember. I mean, this was added. This wasn't part of the paper. It was added by board members on both sides that were concerned that, let's assume I had 10 short-term leases during the year, and that resulted in $100 of expense. But right before 12/31, I enter into 100 short-term leases, such that if I were to record that liability, a user has no idea that that's what's coming over the horizon. That was the intention of that discussion back in March when that was added. So that is what they're going for. For a company that has a steady state type of short-term leasing activity where we're not talking about a huge difference, there is no disclosure to make there. Your short-term lease expense greater than 30 days is what you have in there, and you wouldn't have to make any additional disclosure.
But Scott, the important word is commitment here. You have to be committed before your end. It's not a forecast of how much you will spend on lease next year. It's you have taken a commitment, might not be in comparison to your usual short-term expense, so it has to be disclosed as being a bit special.
Yes?
Yes.
So just to clarify, is it something then that you want us to think about and bring back?
Can we live with this?
Yeah?
We can. Okay.
Oh, sorry. So we were going to. So we do. We voted and agree on the short-term lease expense modified.
Except for
Ian.
In favor. Yes.
In favor.
That's not everybody.
Yeah.
You're in favor.
Short-term, right?
There was one except. Yeah.
It's 11.
11.
11. Okay.
Next, the small asset lease expense.
Only when material.
Obviously, everything is only when material.
Yeah.
One, two, six. Everyone except me.
13-1.
Variable lease expense. That's everyone.
All in favour.
So sublease income would only be for whom it's not a business model, right?
Yeah.
Okay, can I just ask a question on that? Sorry, I should have asked it earlier. Is this lease income on right of use assets that you've sublet? What about owned assets that you've?
It's not a sublease.
Sublease.
What's special
about lease income on a leased asset versus lease income on an owned asset.
That about the table, because you would probably, if it was material, you would have to show lease income, whether it was on your own assets or on subleased assets. The first question is, do you have to show income on sublease? Yes, because you also have to show income if it's material on lease. But the last question you're going to ask us is where you have to show it. Mm. I think what you're talking about is, do you have to show both? Yes. Where is the question?
Exactly.
But, so I think sublease, I'd say yes. And come back to the question.
It doesn't qualify for offsetting. You cannot offset. No. Because it's different parties. So it has to be shown gross. Why then present it here?
Well, the reason we would think that it's quite, let's categorize, that's why we think that, you know, Wegu's point raised yesterday is a valid one when sublease incomes end up being your revenue. But when you picture this, as we say, as Catherine described, as a normal lessee who's not in the business of leasing out stuff, that's not their business, but they're just a lessee and they happen to have a bit of spare space, you know, when they entered into these contracts, they, you know, expected to use them all, they don't now. And so the sublease income piece is, it's really, we would picture as being kind of a negative on their lease expense, in a sense, you know, it's that they've got lease expenses, but on the same assets that they're paying, you know, cash flows out, they're getting cash flows in, and we would see benefit in having that information together.
Is that Steve's characterization of income from leasing right-of-use assets? And if we just describe it that way, it at least says this is the income we're talking about.
Does that address your point? Because I think, I mean, that we can certainly do that. Does that address
It doesn't address the, is it revenue or not?
Yeah.
Because I think that comes back to, are we putting all the leasing information in one place or not? It just says, do we want that split out from other income?
My point is just that we don't put lease income or owned assets in the same place as the depreciation of the owned asset. So what's special about this?
I think that's a generic point about, do we put all the leasing disclosures together or not?
Yes.
It's just a manifestation of that.
If someone perform as a lessor, we have no disclosure requirement here at all.
It's a different package. No, we would have a package of disclosures for the source later on, right?
You've already decided on
that.
No, I understand what you're saying. Which is, we could have bought a building and intended to use it all and have a bit of spare space, and that's that. We don't.
You're linking it to the liability you've incurred on the lease.
Yeah.
Recovering some of the lease.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I think one important point is that it's not to convey a message that you can offset lease income against his expense or lease receivables against his liabilities. They do not qualify for offsetting.
No.
You may want to regroup the information, but it should be clear that it's not something you can not net on the face of the financial statements. Correct?
I mean, I don't know if it's also that it might be that this is just about, should we have the information disclosed, first of all. It might be solved, if that's a big issue, by the next question, which will come, which is whether we mandate tabular formats or not.
Okay, so where do we go now?
Have we voted on sublease income?
Yeah. I don't think we have.
As justified staff, yes?
Yeah.
Ten. Okay.
Cash flow.
So the total lease expense was gone, right?
Yeah, that's gone. Yeah. Total cash flow? Mm-hmm.
Total cash flow?
I think total cash flow to some extent related to sublease and others. That's the problem. I don't know what total cash flow means.
13.
Yeah. Cash outflow, yeah. Is it more specific to say cash outflow?
At the moment, we intended it to be intended to be apples net. For apples compared to what's above. So it was intended to be net of that sublease income.
It doesn't qualify for netting. You can't offset either in the revenue, the P&L, or in the cash flow, because they are different parties. And I think it's obscure information. The risks are different. It's different parties. So why net?
Well, we would agree with that. The reason we proposed it for disclosure, we're not proposing any netting in any primary statements, is because
we envisaged that as being a comparable disclosure to the lease expenses that we were disclosing. So we were thinking this one note would give a complete picture of all the expenses and all the cash flows.
So it just
and with regard
the total
to
lease expense.
Well, yes.
I think I would go along cash outflows for leasing. And if material disclose cash inflows, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so not subtract subleases.
Yeah.
Do we agree with that modification that we do not subtract subleases? Yes.
Yeah.
Can I see?
So it now becomes total cash outflows.
Yeah.
12.
Just do it again.
I think it was 12. So 12.
14.
12, 13. Additions to ROU assets?
All in favour?
Okay, then the weighted average. There were a lot of people against that. Who is in favour? Nobody.
I'm in favour.
Oh, you're saying. Patrick is in favour.
Yep. Absolutely.
Then gains on sale and leaseback transactions. That was a mixed bag as well.
I'm in favour.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
6 in favour. We voted for now. 7 in favour.
Convergence.
This is also
a
convergence issue.
I think you just got
it. Yeah. I can.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay.
So then we need to vote on whether the table is.
Could I ask you to take it in two pieces? One is, should we have all the least, should we be requiring all the lease disclosures to be presented together, and then separately, should we require a tabular presentation? I think they're two different issues.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so first, should it be...
Should we vote on the carrying?
Oh, sorry, I was walking down the recommendation.
Maybe vote on the carrying amount.
Okay.
Sorry, just vote on the carrying amount.
Yeah.
We really need to vote on that.
That's carrying amount?
What's carrying amount?
Split by class.
All in favour?
Yep. And so now do Mary's first of all.
So the first question is, will we require to for all this lease information to be presented in one place?
Yes.
That's
okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay. Then do we require that to be done in a tabular form as format as prescribed here?
With the modification that Alan obviously suggested.
Yeah. It could be in tabular format unless.
That's not required.
No,
that's
this is different, yes.
Well, I'd require it. And I have to say, Hans, what I think is very important here in the post-implementation review is if the short-term lease expense and small asset expense, obviously, to Tuck's point, as he's emphasized multiple times now, is only disclosed if it's material. But if it starts becoming a larger number, then the two items above it, I don't want to have to go hunting. And if it is material, someone's going to bury it somewhere else in the financial statements.
Yeah. No, we just said it has to be all in one place.
Yeah.
Oh, in the same notes.
Yeah.
We can read all the notes.
Anyway, I'd like to avoid creating motivation and opportunity for gamesmanship here.
Okay.
So I think we've only three voted to require a tabular format. Now do we want to vote on what's the wording would be as to like encourage a tabular format, which would say, you know, kind of provide this in tabular format
unless
another
like
format
that.
Is more.
That comes pretty close to requiring.
Yeah.
I don't think it's appropriate really in a standard set a level to encourage anything in the standard. Or we either require or not.
This creates a lot of simplicity.
Yeah, but encourage is not really appropriate. I don't agree.
We don't, just to quote you the words we have, at least I'm quoting from IFRS 12 at the minute, so something we've got somewhere else. It says, an entity shall disclose in tabular format unless another format is more appropriate.
I do disagree with that. I continue to disagree.
Okay.
No
one question. Can this table include cross-references?
Tabular format? Probably.
Well, given that we said you had to put it all in one note.
So if everything is in one place, but what's in that one place is just a list of cross-references, does that satisfy? That's okay.
Satisfy the standard.
That would satisfy.
Yes, that's okay, because you can find it in one place.
But they should know where to look.
Okay, so has the delivery paperless, as it was, been completed?
Yes.
Yes.
I think so.
Okay.